Welcome to Dear Asian Generation, the podcast you wish you had growing up.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Dear Asian Generation. That's right. We're hitting y'all with a rebrand. We are now Dear Asian Generation. We are so excited to tell you more about it. But before we dive in, I'm Isabel Leong.
I'm Nina.
I'm Abby.
I'm Meghna.
And I'm Eden. So that's all of our co-hosts here today. But regarding our rebrand, what was the reason for it? So essentially, the essence of who we are and who we make this podcast for hasn't changed at all. We're still the same DAG team, and we've always sought to be as inclusive as possible, like with our previous episodes about aspects of the Asian identity and the Asian experience that don't fit neatly into boxes. So talking about like queerness and being trans. But we didn't feel like the title or the slogan of our podcast really best illustrated this kind of inclusivity, which is at the heart of what we do. So we really wanted to adapt our language, essentially, while retaining our focus on the experience of Asian girlhood and femininity, which a lot of people, regardless of whether or not they feel represented by the label of girl, can relate to. So really, this is just a linguistic redirection. It's not a conceptual one at all. We're not changing. We're still DAG, and we're still here for you. We're just Dear Asian Generation now. But before we dive into our highly anticipated Q&A today, which we'll get into in a bit, we just want to hear from you guys what this new rebrand means to you. What does Dear Asian Generation mean to you? And what are you most excited about regarding this rebrand? So we can go ahead and answer that ourselves first.
So for me, I'm like super excited for this rebrand, mostly for a lot of things, because one, I'm always huge about like more inclusive language. But second of all, I'm just happy that we can grow up, not necessarily in the sense where, you know, we can't have our youthful charms, which we have. We love being silly. But the term girl, especially recently, as it's been oversaturated, when people are like, girl dinner, girl math, girl everything. Mm-hmm. Like, no, I'm turning 23 this year. I'm old. I don't know if I'm a girl anymore. Like, and that's okay. And that's okay with me, you know? And so I like the term Dear Asian Generation a little bit for that. We're growing up and you guys are growing up with us.
Yeah, I relate to that. I also think that for me, girl, the fact that it's like Dear Asian Girl, by Asian girls, for Asian girls, like the girl agenda to me pushes us a little, not, I mean, it's not turfy, but I just, my brain goes straight to like JK Rowling, you know, when it's like girl, girl, girl. And it's like saying it once is okay. You know, girl, to me, girl is like girl, like G-W-O-R-L, you know, like that's including not just people who are like cis girls and cis women, you know, to me, that means more. But I don't think that's always clear. Not everybody thinks of the word girl like that. So when we're like girl, 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 it's a bit turfy.
Yeah. I also like the fact, like, just linguistically, the idea of like transitioning from girl, like being an individual girl in our name versus like generation, which is a literal collective. Mm. I think it also reflects how much DAG has grown in general. I mean, first of all, like, I've moved continents during the course of me being a podcast host. So I feel like in general, Dear Asian Girl, well, now Generation, has got such a more worldly perspective and viewpoint to show. Like, we have a variety of time zones here, and like for our audience members, like, it's been a struggle, or not a struggle, but like, we are navigating time zones and like so many other different factors and perspectives, and I think it just goes to show how much more of a collective we are able and lucky to embody.
Yeah, and how expansive we can be, and like the growth that we can have. Like, I can envision this podcast going on for so long, and like that name, Dear Asian Generation, lives up to what we want to create. We want to empower a generation of people who are inclusive, who are change makers, who can make a difference. And it's so great to be a part of it, you know?
Yeah, and building off of what Isabel said about this being like a long lasting, enduring project, when I think of Dear Asian Generation, what I'm most excited for with this rebrand is this idea of reaching across time to future generations, and just the millions upon millions of Asian youth who are going to emerge into this world in the future. And when I think about this podcast, I think about the fact that even after we all age and move on to other things, all of the content we've created is going to remain on these platforms. And essentially, DAG is kind of like a time capsule. It's our gift to the next generation and to generations to come. It's our love letter to all of the other Asian youth who will be born into this world. So that's why I am super stoked for Dear Asian Generation and for this to be our legacy. So I'm also like just super excited for this. And I'm so glad that we're all on the same page with how happy we are for this change. So now that we've established that we're going through this rebranding stage, we just want to let you guys know that we are going to be starting off our upcoming season 8 with a few chatty off-season episodes before we dive into a very highly anticipated season. It's a really highly personal season, really relevant to pretty much all of us co-hosts. So stay tuned for the official season 8 theme name to be announced, which is going to be all about the LGBTQ+ identity, culture, and relationships, which brings us to today, where we're doing a chatty episode where we are going to ask some burning questions about the LGBTQ+ experience that all of our wonderful co-hosts are going to answer today. So we just have a couple questions that we're going to start off with just to ease ourselves into this conversation. We're going to start with this question. So all of you guys here, when did you first know you were queer? Was there someone, a celebrity crush, someone you knew who catalyzed your awakening?
Okay, this is always a really interesting question to me because I feel like, well, I mean, I think it's a pretty typical thing to do to compare it to kind of what you would ask like a heterosexual person. And it's like, there isn't really a moment where you know, or at least for me, I'm speaking personal experience, but there's not a moment where it just suddenly clicks. So it kind of feels like you just always are that way. So for me, this question is, if I interpret it more as like, when did you discover the language to accurately describe your identity? Then that's a different kind of thing to me. That could be like quite a recent answer for me. It could be in the past couple of years, like in the past 5 years, maybe, despite me like always knowing that I was queer, because queerness and like the language we use around queerness when we grow up in a heteronormative society is very demonizing. And so you aren't coming across language that isn't like slurs or language that feels like it represents you accurately and positively, or at least like neutrally. So it's not till you get older. And for me, that was like going to uni and being surrounded by loads more queerness because I went to uni in Bristol, which is like queer central, apart from like Brighton in the UK. And so that's when I began to find language that I felt was actually really positive. And I saw queerness talked about in a positive way. So that's when I found the language that I felt accurately depicted who I was. So this is always a really interesting question to me because it's one that comes up pretty frequently, I feel like, in queer discourse, but I always have to question how it's being interpreted, whether it's like in terms of language or whether it's just this like gut feeling of when did you know?
No, I was gonna say, Nana, you put your finger up, right? It's
I was thinking because it sounded similar to what Isabel has been saying in the past about like going to college as well and getting a lot more, I guess, queer presence and queer people in their community. But in terms of me, I guess, in terms of knowing when I was queer, it wasn't like one of those experiences that I feel like is very, in terms of when you like straight people, their conception of being queer and like that trajectory, I think a lot of them think, or there's this idea that like, oh, you know, when you're like 5 years old, you have like this one moment where you're like watching like the television, like you see something, it's like, oh my god, awakening, I know everything. It's not true. That's not true. And I think it was it took me going to an all-girls school for me to learn about that, where yes, unfortunately the stereotype is true in that way. I can affirm that, where there was a pretty prominent gay community, and this is like me being in sixth grade and had no, yeah, 100% just reading the chat, you know, just said 90% of you guys are gay, pretty much. My first queer crush was like a train wreck in the sense that it was like so intense in the like magnitude of the feeling, and then it's only amplified by the fact that like it's such a shameful thing at first. I don't know if that's like everyone's experience, that is a generalization. But I think for me it was, because for the most part in the beginning, I kept it a lot to myself, like naturally, as like a good amount of people, like queer people do. And when thoughts are just like, reverberating in your head, like bouncing off the walls, like they just amplify in intensity. So I think, yeah, that awakening wasn't the most clean, smooth, enjoyable, but I was able to find people that were very supportive, and obviously like I could eventually start to like verbalize it and then get more comfortable with even like the language, like you were saying, Eden. Like language is so important, especially when talking about queerness. And yeah, we're gonna talk more about like labels and like what we feel comfortable with and what we feel like, just more of that discourse as well.
So I'll keep it a little bit shorter because I'm sure that my feelings about this will come up with later questions, but I think that I have always known similarly to what Eden said, but not necessarily because of like cool reasons, I guess. I think there's always this feeling of when you grow up and you just feel off and you just feel kind of different from everyone else. And your brain tries to compartmentalize it as a lot of things. Like, I remember being on Tumblr as a kid, and like, I would see these were like these things about people being like, posts being like, oh, did you know creative people face depression like 30 times more likely or whatever? Or like, there'd be something about like, oh, gay people are more likely to be like this and this. And I'd be like, wow, I relate, but not me though. I love being an ally. But I think that for the better and for the worse, there has been moments in my life where I was made to feel different and in not good ways necessarily, even before I knew it myself. And something like that can be very humbling sometimes. But from a pretty young age, honestly, but like you said, Eden, and what you built upon, like you don't really have the words because who tells you know?
Yeah, I feel like for me it's very similar to what you guys have said. And I think I really resonate with kind of feel the feeling of like being odd, or like not necessarily feeling like full on, honestly, like per like bringing like my full self to like conversations about having crushes and stuff like that. And I think that's kind of when I knew there was something different, but I definitely didn't have the language to say, "Oh, maybe I'm queer," or "Oh, maybe I," because I also don't think it was like an option, Like I think because of like cishet and like all this stuff, like when I was young, there was no other option than being straight. So we'll talk more about that later in the episode.
Okay, yeah, thank you guys for sharing. Just from the perspective of like someone who is cishet, I've always thought it was kind of strange that straight people have this weird fascination with like the moment of gay awakening, the moment of realization, the eureka aha moment, because like you guys said, this has always been your reality. Like this is just who you are, how you are. So like it's just like, why do people think that there was like a moment where you transitioned from like neutral to gay? Like that's just weird. But now that we've answered that question, you guys mentioned a little bit about like your transition period between like just coming into self-awareness as to your guys' sexuality. So another question that I'm interested in asking is, like, what's something you guys knew, or what's something you guys wished you had known when you were in that transition phase where you were questioning and coming out? Or what's something that you would want other people who are in those stages to know and understand?
Well, honestly, it's so weird because even with that question, it's like so complicated because like I fully came in and out as a lesbian like four separate times like in my life. Not necessarily to everyone, but like at least to different people where I was like vocalizing it and I was like feeling it internally. I went in and out like four times. I'm out for sure. I'm staying here. But like it's complicated because in a certain way, you are always in your coming out stage. There's like this beautiful line from this like this song I love called LOL by Power Bottom. And it's called, and it just goes like, when you're queer, you are always 19. And it's like this feeling that, you know, queer people, whether that's because of sexuality or gender or both, we're not given the same experience of time, you know, that heterosexuals, that cis people get. And so in a way, like that feeling of questioning who you are, what you are, it's always kind of lingers there because you aren't given the exact same truths that other people get to benefit from. So something I wish I knew when I first came out, maybe like the first time, is that it's gonna go about like five different times. Like I said four different times, and that's just lesbian. Like there are other probably stuff in the past. Like, so, you know, what you should know is it never stops. I mean, like it can stop, but like you'll always feel like you're growing, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, and I think something.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, just like the concept of like coming out for one. I mean, like we can usually the discourse about like the absurdity of coming out is about the fact that like it's very sensationalized, so that it's like less normalized to be a queer person, but also the fact that like you're supposed to have this like coming out process where you declare that you know yourself completely. How are you expected to know yourself when you're like at the mere ripe age of like a 13 year old to like 19 year old? Like we are forever 19, we're forever rediscovering ourselves. And I think that this is also an experience that like could probably in some shape or form relate to like being any type of minority, whether it's a racial minority, religious minority, sexual minority. Like when you are part of the majority, like if you're a white person, if you're a straight person, you're not expected to like go in, do this process of self-discovery and like really delve into like, what does it mean to be me? You don't need to do that because you are the mainstream. But when you are a gay person, a queer person, it's like, I need to like rationalize this in my head to then export the idea to other straight people to make them comfortable and to like really be able to rationalize me, perceive me with clarity. Because if you think about it, labels are, I mean, of course, like it's good for yourself, but I feel like labels, the pressure that comes with it, the way they can be detrimental is when they're to make other people feel comfortable or to make other people know you better. Like, of course, you want to like share with your friends and families if you can, of course, if you're lucky to be able to do that, like who you are and like share and like your identity and be proud if you're able to do that, of course. But there's so much pressure that comes with it as well. And it's never like a once and done, okay, check the box, move on. So Isabel, please go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to add on to what Abby said and say, like, I don't know, it's so, coming out is such like a, because you're just always, I feel like I'm always just like, oh yeah, like, I guess, like, this is a part of my identity. And like, I don't know, like, especially coming to college and like, you meet like this like swarm of like new people and you're constantly kind of like coming out slash like, meeting people and like you're all kind of coming like coming out is like not even like I don't know, I guess you're kind of just like perceiving other people and other people are perceiving you. And I think that's kind of what I wish I had when I was younger, because it's so much more like open now. But like I don't know, it's just so weird to like talk about like coming out, because I kind of hate I kind of hate the word, the phrase like coming out, because I guess it implies that like I was hiding before. And like I mean, maybe I was, but like now I don't feel that way. So it's like kind of just a part, it's just a part of me that like I don't want to have to justify to other people, you know, like I'm not looking to like tell someone, oh, you know, like I'm gay, like I'm a lesbian. Like I feel like that's not like this like a center of my identity that like a lot of people like deserve to know about. And I think like growing up, like realizing that and thinking about like, oh, not everyone needs to like necessarily know this part of your identity was like kind of a like a revelation to me, because I thought like seeing coming out being so sensationalized, I was like, I need to come out to everyone I know. But that's not
So, I love that concept of like not being out, not meaning that you're hiding, because it's like you're not hiding, like others don't see you, but that doesn't mean you're hiding. And I promise this relates, but have you guys seen the stuff going around on TikTok? I don't remember her name now, it's one account, and she talks about these like micro feminist things she does in her corporate workplace. Like if someone says, oh, I'll just talk to my manager about that, then she'll go out of her way to email back saying, oh, let me know when she responds, or let me know when they respond, rather than saying he automatically. And just like little micro affirming behaviors like that to just like, minutely kind of piss off cishet men. And like similarly in that kind of vein, I hate this concept of like coming out so much. And I think it's just so ridiculous and sensationalized that the micro affirmation that I'll do in return is like, I will just assume that everybody I meet is queer rather than straight, unless they tell me that they're straight. And I just think it's great because you can really tell the kind of person someone is from how they react to that. Like, if they refer to their partner, because straight people use that term as well, but if they refer to their partner and I'll just like use the usual like pronoun that's like the same gender as them, the person I'm talking to, and then if they react badly, it's like, oh, but what's wrong with being queer? Like, oh, I was wrong to assume that you were queer because you're straight, but why would I assume that you were straight when you could also be queer? And like, why are you reacting negatively as if this is a negative thing? But I just think it's really interesting seeing how people react to being assumed to be gay, because it's suddenly like, oh, is it the way I dress? Like, is it the way I look? Because everyone thinks I'm straight as a really femme lesbian, but I am not.
Yeah, I love that so much, Eden. That's so funny.
Or a pansexual. Like, that should be the default. Like, being straight, yeah, that is out of the picture at this point.
No, I love that. I love this idea of, like, making it such that cishet isn't, like, the baseline anymore. Like, that every sexuality is, like, on the table. Like, it's not, like, everyone is automatically straight. It's, like, everyone is automatically ambiguous until you clarify gay is the baseline. That's in the chat. I love that. We should, yes. So it's really interesting everything you guys have been saying, because like I feel like coming out has always been conceptualized as like a one and done, when what you guys have just shared, it's always like an ongoing process, and it's always something that has like multiple like takes, almost like it's something that's continuously happening, which is something that I actually like, I didn't know that. So thank you for sharing all of that. And just to transition to our next question, I'm going to put Nana on the spot for just a moment, just because she was the first to bring this up. But you mentioned like your first queer crush at your school. So I was just wondering, like, what was, if you could expand on that experience, what was that like? What was your first queer experience, relationship, crush? Was it like, was it what you imagined it to be?
I mean, okay. It was when I was like 12, right? So it's just to be pretty like elementary stuff. Like, I'm not having deep thoughts when I'm too old. Like, I mean, I probably thought I was at the time, you know? But I think in terms of like what you know about crushes at that point, it's like, oh my gosh, Timmy likes me. Like, you know, it's like that, like running around, like girls running around being like, oh my God, this guy is so like, ew, da da da, you know, like things like that. This is very eloquent. But I think realizing that it was not just like, oh, this is just a very intense friendship where I just want to be around them all the time because I love them as a friend so much. It was more than that. And I think after realizing it, I sort of went on like that whole almost like stereotypical like rampage of like looking up online and like gay quizzes, like signs of being gay, da 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 da. Like I was doing all this research. I was trying so hard to rationalize it in my brain. And I wanted to let myself like feel the feelings of like, it's a crush. You are a 12-year-old. Just like enjoy it, but then I was also very, very, I guess, obsessed, not with the person, but like the idea of it. And more so, like, I sensationalized it a lot in my head. Like, I wish going back, I could have been a bit more chill or a bit more like casual in my head about it. But I felt the need to also make it like so much of like my brain energy, like occupy so much of my brain energy. Because again, like, it's when you are a queer or a gay person, it's like, that almost becomes your identity marker. It's like before you are a person, you are queer.
Yeah, completely relate. Also, love that you mentioned quizzes, like am I gay quizzes and all the tests and stuff, because I think that's like unanimously, like we all just did that. We all did the quizzes and they all came out telling us that we were gay. And we were all like,
oh, like green bunny, I'm a really good 100%. Why are you taking this quiz? Like, get off. Wait, here.
Like, I'm taking them now. Like, I'm taking them now just as like a little something, something, you know?
And the like, collective
you go back. Yep.
The lesbian combat master dog.
Oh my God.
Wait. Like,
pause. That's a whole thing in itself.
The way that actually.
Wait, I'm sorry. For the straight people in the audience, what is the lesbian combat master dog?
Oh my gosh.
I just need the floor to be broken down.
I can't do it justice. So pivotal.
So basically, this person, like, you know, it's their own experience, so bless their soul. They made this master doc essentially about being like, are you a lesbian? And like kind of devolving into content and stuff. And like it was kind of on like online frequently because, you know, a lot of queer people gather online because we don't have as much of real life spaces anymore. Like it was used as like this Bible of figuring out if you're a lesbian. And I'm gonna be real. That actually like hindered my experience of like coming
out. I can understand
out.
That. I really can. Yeah.
Because I was like, I don't know. Like, I guess I don't feel like this. So maybe I'm not. Because I think sometimes your brain will jump for being like, I'm probably not. But oh my gosh, Isabel, did you just
bookmarked it?
Sorry, for all of our listeners.
On this link so fast.
Yes. I'm so curious for you to give your opinion reading it. Also, interesting, it tells the age of it because the flag that it's showing is no longer the commonly used lesbian flag. Mm-hmm. In fact, I would actually like to shout out the original creator of the new lesbian flag, whose name is Emily Gwen. They get no money for everything that they do, which is the creation of the flag, and they deserve it all. So I hope that they can, I hope, you know, if you're listening out there, let's send some money to Emily Gwen. But it's a 31 page document. Give us your opinion, Meghna. I want you to like walk us through your feelings about it.
I'll just say, one takeaway that like I think the last time I read it was like 3 years ago. So I've like left my like lesbian master dog reading analyzing phase. But I think a good substantial amount of the content there is about your relationship with like men, right? And content and thinking like, oh, because of the fact that I have so much like, I guess, like adrenaline or like nervous feelings around men, that means I'm straight, when in reality it could be just you wanting to seek male validation. And I think that is what resonated with me a bit, because definitely I'm very much like a girly girl. I'm very much rooted in my femininity. But I think growing up, I felt that my femininity, like gender-wise had to be rooted in liking men, and that my entire gender self-concept had to be about my relationship to men, appeasing their wants, appeasing to the male gaze, and then to be gay or to be bi or whatever the hell, right? Like meant defying that, and it meant like revoking the feminine side of me. So I think reading the master talk was a bit helpful in that regard. But I mean, it is one person's experience, and it's definitely full of a bunch of generalization. So it's not like a, you know, again, like a checklist, like, oh, I fit like these criteria. Okay, I'm good. I'm set. No.
Yeah, I think the thing for me, I'm just like echoing what you said, basically, but it was less so the document itself, like the 31 page document, and more so like realizing and discovering this term compulsory heterosexuality that was more useful to me and more like conducive to me like becoming more aware of who I was and falling into my like now identity. So just to explain kind of quick what comphet is, when a lot of people who are lesbian but don't yet know it, for instance, are on their journey of coming out, you can struggle with identifying the fact that you're attracted to women, but it tends to be more so that what you struggle with is understanding that you aren't attracted to men, and it's just this compulsory heterosexuality in you, enforced on you by the society you grew up in and the culture that you grew up in, that makes you think that you do. And so I think for me, learning about that concept and kind of breaking it down myself was more useful than the master doc specifically and going through all the 31 pages, because I think it kind of oversimplifies it. Like, I know it's 31 pages, but I think sort of posing it as this like exhaustive list is like, at the same time as it's overcomplicating it, it's also oversimplifying it, kind of. And so that is also why it wasn't that helpful for me. It was just more so that, like, as it is for a lot of queer people, this is the first time that I had heard of the term compat. So that was what was useful for me. Anyway, Meghna, please give your opinions about this doc as the token cishet here.
I love that. I love that that's my role, as it should be. Okay, I'm scrolling through this PDF, and I'm just, like, kind of in awe with how, like, thorough it seems to be. Like, there are so many categories here that it's just like covering so much. Like, there's like signs of compulsory heterosexuality. There's like the fact that you can have like pseudo crushes on male celebrities and fictional men, but it's not like genuine attraction. And I don't think I can like read all of this in like the 5 minutes we had between the question and me being introduced to this doc, but I am just like, even though you guys said that it was very much a generalization, I'm like really glad that there have been like products like this out there that someone like went through like or took the time to like put this together as like a way to support other people out there who might be questioning themselves or who might feel confused or conflicted. That's just the fact that someone like had the empathy and the love to like take time out of their day without being compensated to just put this together is so, I just think that's so beautiful. So I'm glad that you guys like had this, even if it, you know, isn't completely accurate, or even if it, like in Abby's case, might have hindered your experience a little bit. I'm glad that there was someone out there who was thinking of you and who wanted there to be some sort of guide, because I'm sure like all of everything you guys experienced was probably so complicated and it might have felt a little more secure to have like a manual, quote unquote, like this. So I just think it's amazing. I hope there's like an updated version coming out soon just to kind of reconcile with some of the
sequel is crazy. Oh my god.
someone write a 2.0.
I will say two things about it, and then I have something I'd also like to like say. First of all, apparently the person who created the master doc is now a bisexual. So it's just like, it should just be saying that the best thing that you can do.
You guys can't see this, but Eden is like gobsmacked, like jaw dropped. Like, it's like the
I'm in shock.
I mean, yeah, because it's like, the thing is, you know, like what I discovered is that you can have all the language in the world. And I was on Tumblr at a very young age. So I was not here being like learning about micro labels, even, you know. You can have all the language in the world, but at some point, like, it's about experience. It's about living life and your brain coming to that realization. Cause you can say things, but like, can you feel it? You know, like I could say, oh, compet is a thing, compet's a thing. Could I recognize that in my life though? And I couldn't until I could. Eden just said, I gotta say this out loud, the bi to lesbian to bi pipeline is a real thing. And so is the bi to lesbian to bi to lesbian pipeline. It's very real. And, you know, to all of our listeners, I know we're mostly talking about lesbians right now, which is not necessarily everyone in this group. In fact, I know we were talking about coming out right now, but I was like, actually, I don't even know if we've officially come out to each other about given good updates about where we're all at, but not that we, I don't know if it would be counterproductive for us to do that, because it's like we just were like, we don't have to. But I think that these guides exist too, and so many people who are not necessarily lesbians now know about that guide. And I think it's interesting to see that there was one that was created for this, like specifically for lesbians. I was like, crazy. Anyways, also talking about gay crushes and relationships, like the first moment where you, like Nana was talking about it, but like the pipeline of being a child and having a best friend, and there's like, wait, both of you might like each other, but then also you're both young, and also like you're in a volatile time, like high school or middle school, and so you immediately fall out. Any opinions on that, everyone?
Okay, I don't have a specific point that relates to that, although, oh my god, that pipeline is, I feel like everyone can relate to that on some level.
We have witnessed,
yeah. But on the topic of like first queer relationships, I feel like as I'm getting older and like I'm more mature and coming into myself, and I'm also like now in the healthiest queer relationship I've been in ever, I'm starting to look back on my first queer relationship, which was very traumatizing, with a lot more kindness and a lot more gentleness towards myself, maybe not towards the other person, but towards myself, because for a long time afterwards, after that experience, I would make jokes as a way to kind of cope with the actual damage it had done to me and the really wrong and horrible things it had taught me about like love and relationships and trust. And I think this is all just because being young and queer is a really isolating experience. It's like you're watching all of your cis and or het friends around you get their first crushes and their first boyfriends and even go through their first breakups, and you feel like you're missing out and they're leaving you behind. This is why we play Falling Behind by Leve. But so when you finally do find that kind of love for yourself, you like dive into it head first with like reckless abandon. You just like throw yourself into it. You're launching yourself into the experience. And you think this is coupled with the tendency in like young queer culture, but also, and Meghna, I kind of want you to chip in here afterwards, but also in like straight women culture to over glorify women and to talk about and over glorify lesbianism as in, oh, it must be so much easier for you. I love that you can just date women and you don't have to deal with men. And like, it must be so good. Women can do no wrong. And that kind of thinking, when that gets embedded into a young queer person in their first, and I'm talking specifically about like lesbian relationships because that's been my experience, but when that's what's been embedded with you, it's really hard for you to see toxic signs and red flags. And it's really hard for you to believe that the person that you're seeing could be anything but some like transcendental, goddess-like, infallible being. Like, you just don't think that you could be being mistreated. And so that's why I think a lot, although not all, first queer relationships you hear about are really toxic, even like to the extent of being abusive or to the point of being like manipulative or just doing some kind of emotional damage. So I think it's that coupled with the fact of like feeling really lonely and like you're missing out growing up and then finally seeing something and throwing yourself into it. It's that together that for me, I feel like is why your first queer relationship can be really rough, to say the least.
I'm like so beyond chronically obsessed with everything you just said. I think we have another question on here that like I would love to recircle back to because there's so much to be said there. But in terms of like how being queer and being Asian intersects, I think part of like throwing yourself into being loved, that's so, I mean, I'm speaking from my perspective, like that's so real because growing up Asian, like the Asian diaspora in like a Western world, it is so easy and like it's so likely that you're going to be ingrained with the idea that you are undesirable, you are not beautiful, you do not fit the lens of someone who will be ever perceived as someone who will be able to have like the experiences of your white straight friends who are getting their first crushes, their first relationships, and like all these milestones when you're young and like that's what you know yearn after or whatever. And that intersection of being queer, having that shame and isolation, and then also like the decreased likelihood of even being able to be out and find other people your young age that are also comfortable with being in a relationship or being out. It's like when that actually happens, you just jump straight into it. And then the whole like conversation or the like narrative that like is also perpetuated by straight women for like, oh yeah, like gay relationships are so much easier like for women because women are so, you know, they're only emotionally mature. They're so much better than men. I mean, I'm all for the androphobia to like a very reasonable extent, but it's so erasive and reductive in terms of like the real like insanity that can happen in women loving women relationships. So yeah, I wish like my younger self could hear what you just said, Eden, because it is so easy to like have the first initial like, you know, a moment of like affection or like love or whatever that may be, especially after like that, like love is the antidote to shame. So when you have like all that affection for another gay person in a gay relationship, it's like of course you're going to be yearning for that because it like you wanted to fix whatever shame you've carried about your sexuality and about your identity.
Okay, first I want to say thank you to Eden for sharing something that was very heavy and obviously probably very vulnerable for her. And also just want to thank all of you for your contributions to that discussion. And also I want to touch on this point that Eden mentioned about like straight women glorifying lesbian relationships, because I feel like especially in college, I think I've seen that like a lot more frequently or a lot more prominently than I did in like, I guess, middle school or high school. Like, I don't know if people know what they're doing or if it's necessarily meant in that sense. But like, for example, I know a lot of like a lot of my friends who I know for a fact are not queer, not lesbian, will like kind of interact with each other in like ways where I don't know how to explain this. Like, it's not like a bad thing, or like I don't know. I feel like it's not a bad thing because I feel like they don't mean any harm by it. But like, it's like making jokes, like I want to kiss you so bad, or like they like flirt with each other and stuff like that. Which I think, okay, I mean, I don't. I feel like it's understood that it's like not, I guess, meant in the sense that they're queer, but I feel like women at least are very like a lot more like willing, or I feel like willing isn't the word to use, but I see a lot of like women who aren't necessarily queer like kind of engaging in behaviors that quote unquote seem queer in the sense. Like I just feel like this is something, or maybe this is just something that's like specific to my friend group. I don't know if like other female friend groups do this, but like I've noticed that a lot. Like I'm not sure where it stems from. I'm not sure if it's like trying to kind of put yourself in a pseudo relationship or something, but this is all to say, I definitely feel like there is a little bit of a like a glorification or kind of idealization of like what a lesbian relationship is, just because a lot of straight women from my experience have been like very much on the point of like, it would be so much easier if I could just be in love with my best friend, like if I could just do that, and like if we could just get married in the future. Like, oh, there's so many pacts where it's like, if we're both single at 30 years old, let's get married for the tax benefits or something like that. And I guess like me personally, I've always wondered like, is this harmful or helpful or neither or both, in the sense that like, are we helping to normalize the idea of queer relationships by like openly engaging in this type of conversation and this type of interaction, or are we kind of trivializing it because this is not our experience, this is the experience of people who are genuinely queer, and what are we doing when we are having these conversations, when we are like engaging in these interactions? And I hope you guys understand where I'm going with that. So just to kind of, does anyone else have anything else to say on this point, or should we pivot to our next point? Because Nana mentioned
sorry. Well, it's kind of building off of that. Like recently I was thinking about a lot of the reasons why I went to all girls high school, a little bit similar to Nana. And I feel like I didn't connect a lot with the majority of the people there because of the way I centered like men in my, or I didn't center men in my life. And I just remember being in conversations where my friends would be talking about their guy crushes, and I'd be like, "Ooh, I have nothing to contribute." And I mean, you know, like, that doesn't mean I'm not friends with straight people. It just means like I felt like so many people cared about like the male gaze and like centering men in their life. But for me, I was so far removed from that because I think I just like didn't want male attention. So I was so like, ooh, like I don't really know how to relate, because a lot of my friends were like, a lot of like the big conversations were about guys. And it wasn't like, oh, I was like uncomfortable, because it was like they were talking about men, but it was like, oh, maybe I like shouldn't be here because I have nothing to build on this conversation. And I think a lot of like my close friendships in high school were with people where we like just didn't talk about like relationships, and we didn't really talk about like, oh, like, who do you like? Like, ooh, that was like, I feel like that was never like a question that like I really posed, because I always knew that it was gonna be like a guy that like was not a great person for my friend. And I like, don't really know how to like say that, you know? And then also kind of the way I like presented like now and like growing up, like I would say like I'm less femme than a lot of my friends. So I feel like also talking about like clothes and like stuff like that, I never really could like talk about that stuff either. And also just like I remember when like prom would come around or like semi-formal and people would be like, oh my God, like what dress are you gonna get? And I was like, I don't want to wear a dress. Like that's not for me. And even now it's like, oh, like we're talking about dresses, like how does this dress look? And I have a formal coming up and I'm like, ooh, I don't know what I'm gonna wear. And it's just like, ooh, I don't know, like maybe I should I need to figure that out right now. But like I think growing up and going through like experiencing all that stuff, I've become more aware of like, I don't know, just going through those like key moments of like talking about straight crushes, but then like how do I like talk about like my girlfriend or like going to dances and talking about like, oh, who are you bringing? What are you wearing? Like as I keep going through that, like I get better and better at it, but it's still like sometimes very isolating.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I from the perspective that I'm sitting at right now, like I feel like there's a lot more ambiguity here than I first thought when I was approaching this conversation. Like, I think, I don't know, I feel like I always thought people who identify as queer are a lot more kind of settled in their identity, but from what I'm hearing, it's very much not the case, and Abby is profusely agreeing with that point. So thanks for like, I guess like expanding on that, because I feel like it's probably a resonating point with a lot of people who are kind of in that turbulent time period and will continue to be in that kind of turbulent period for a while. So I want to, I feel like it would be remiss to not ask this next question, because obviously, Dear Asian Generation, the Asian experience is something that is central to our organization, to the conversations that we hope to have with each other and with other people. So just to bring back something that Naina mentioned about this intersectionality between the queer and the Asian experience, I wanted to ask you guys, how does that intersectionality. How does that
Intersectionality.
I'm sorry. How does that intersectionality, like, how is that present for you? And what's unique about your particular identity of being quote unquote Gaysian?
So I think it's really interesting being Gaysian because it's made me realize that I think community, to say the queer community, is a very abstract concept frequently. It's mostly just using it as a demographic label. And even then, I would say gay community, because I think for me, queer hints at a sense of something a little bit more revolutionary. Queer is different than being gay. I believe like gay is the generalized term because it hints to a sense of not wanting to necessarily follow the norms. And so what I found was back when I was in an environment where I was at a college that was Christian, and to be gay of any kind was literally in the rule books. Like you could get expelled if you did anything. And where I had to see friends and peers of mine who were queer suffer, and I suffered. I had a really bad time there. But at the same time, it was the second most racially diverse school in the country. And so, unironically, I had this very strong coalition and community of queer people that weren't necessarily all Asian or even like all people of color. Like, there were white people in there too. But then it was so weird because when I got to Seattle, when I came back and I started attending a new college, I made me realize that, especially when you are in a place where queerness is safer, where you are more free to be it, that it's hard for me to say that I can have community with people who are white, with white queers. Not to say that I can't and that it's impossible. It's just that there becomes this thing where I think sometimes white people forget once they are queer that they're also white. Because to be queer is their first material, tangible experience when it comes to their like life identity of being marginalized, that they forget the parts of it that maybe they need to hold themselves accountable to still, and also the ability to still have empathy with people of color, BIPOCs, who are queer, whose experiences aren't that straightforward, who aren't that simple. I also find it really difficult to find community with queer people who had fully embraced, who have never had to question their queerness or had to never face real, like, genuine harm from it, whether from people like in their lives intimately or their everyday experience, because it's really hard to unsee the world as it is after you experience that. And so what I found is that for me, to be Gaysian is the highest sense of community I've been able to get for both being a queer person, but then also for being an Asian person. And that's very beautiful. Heart.
Abby, that was beautiful. Oh my God. Thank you so much for sharing that. I think we can all kind of echo that in a sense. I also just want to add that it's definitely complex, I think, being Gaysian, like being gay and also Asian. At first, I felt really like rejected by my own culture because it is so difficult to talk about like anything that carries emotion, I think, with my family, like talking about being gay or like talking about mental health, talking about anything like this, which is considered kind of like taboo. So I always felt kind of rejected by my own culture, but as a consequence of being Gaysian. But then, and this was like super recently, it was like in the last couple of years of uni that I read East Side Voices, which is a collection of like short stories and essays edited by Helena Lee. And there's a couple of essays in there that talk about, like, for example, like the lady boys in Thailand. And I just realized through reading all of these essays that queerness and transness has literally always existed in Southeast Asian culture since the beginning. We just don't use this like Western form of language and the labels that we are used to using right now. So it's always existed. Like, we have always been here is always the phrase you hear people say, and it's true. And we have always been here across all cultures, even if you don't see language that looks like it's the same. So that was kind of one aspect of me grappling with being Gaysian. And then I won't go into this because it could be a whole thing, but I just want to drop it in here as food for thought. But white women loving women, the way that they fetishize Asian women loving women is a conversation that so many people are not ready for. That is all I will say on that.
That is a bit too real. And I have my thoughts as well, but I cannot go because that will, like, big rabbit hole. But I think what I will say about me, my intersection with being Asian and queer, like, okay, well, for one, to be gay as well, like, the whole idea of, like, the way it's sensationalized, like, oh, like, to come out, like, you are so liberated, you are so free, and, like, so authentically, genuinely, your good old gay-loving self, right? Like, to be a proud, very unabashedly authentic version of yourself is, in some ways, so anti-Asian for me, like, in the way, like, I've gone about my Asianness in terms of, like, the way my family dynamics are, the way, like, my culture is, like, when I'm at my family reunions, like, I'm a much more reductive version of myself. Like, for one, I mean, no, none of my extended family would ever know I'm queer or, like, anything along those lines. But I'm very quiet, and, like, that's, like, how I'm disrespectful. Like, I'm just, you know, sitting with my legs crossed very timidly. And I feel like the way I've grappled with my Asian and queer identity is, like, diametrically opposed. And I feel like, actually, when I was living in Los Angeles, like, a place where, like, it's a city that actually has pride on, like, many other, like, major cities, I felt it was much more easier to be more diving more into my queer identity. And I was also much more surrounded by white people. So I felt more connected with being gay at the time rather than being Asian. And then moving to Singapore, like, it's no, like, you know, like, it's, I mean, it's not difficult to understand that now I feel more connected to my Asian side rather than my queer side. So it's been sort of a reversal, and I'm trying to like merge the two so I can have not necessarily having like one identity cancel out the other. Like I'm still grappling with how to have them coexist because almost like ideologically in my head they seem so diametrically opposed. And yeah, I don't know if this is a common experience.
I think having like coming to college and having more queer Asian friends, like I feel like at home I had so many white queer friends, but coming to college and like, first of all, GSA, sorry, what is it called here? Like Prism. Oh, I just felt like it was like a white queer space. It didn't feel like I was going there and I was like, I don't know, there was definitely like, it's not just all white people, but I think the way they presented themselves is so different to like how I'm culturally used to like expressing my identity. And it's very like, I don't know, I'm still working on like being like really out and loud and proud about my identity. And I think that's like you can kind of tell from when like I'm coming, like what I'm saying about like coming out and stuff, like, oh, I don't feel the need to like come out to everyone. But like coming to college and having more like Gaysian friends, now it's like like yes, like it makes so much more sense, and like there's so many more people to talk about like my queerness with that understand the other complexities of, you know, Asian culture, and just like, you know, navigating like, oh, like code switching a little bit of this, a little bit of that. But yeah, I just wanted to like pop in and say that, like, I don't know, meeting more people and like going to places that are, I wouldn't say like more diverse, but like just like going, just like coming to college and like going to places where there's more gender diversity and like queer diversity is so, I don't know, it really like made me feel more belonged in the world.
Okay, that was beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing all of that, guys. I just want to just add one thing to this conversation because I thought it was really interesting the way Naina talked about Asianness and queerness slash gayness being diametrically opposed, while Eden was talking about how it's always been part of Asian culture. I thought that was a really interesting contrast because that's something that I've also noticed. For example, specifically in Hindu culture. I grew up with a lot of stories. I grew up with reading this one type of like kind of graphic novel called Amrachitagatha, where it's just like a compilation of Indian myths. And something that has always been very prominent to me is the fact that the LGBTQ plus identity has been represented in ancient Indian stories for millennia, for thousands of years. There are trans people in ancient Indian mythology. There are genderqueer people in ancient Indian mythology. And I always thought it was so interesting, this idea of gayness being opposed to Asianness when it has been enshrined in our mythology. It is our gods, our heroes, our genderqueer, our trans. And I think it's just such a shame that because of colonialism, because of this imposition of Western culture on Asian culture, that's changed, that is not the case anymore, that people forget that our gods, our heroes are part of the LGBTQ plus community as well. So thank you for that valuable conversation. I know that we have talked a lot about some very heavy themes, some very complex themes. Just to wrap up this conversation, this Q&A episode, I want to segue into some of our more lighthearted and fun questions that we have here, because we are also a podcast where we want to uplift people and bring light and energy to these types of conversations. So I have two questions for you guys before we wrap up. The first one is, just going around real quick, what were your guys's first celebrity crushes?
Oscar Isaac. That was, I know this because this is the only, like, I remember in my diary, I was like, when I first was watching that news, the start to the new, like, sequels with, like, the new trilogy with, like, Star Wars, The Force Awakens, and stuff, I literally was in that movie theater and I was like, I want him. I want him so bad when I saw him. And it was so, I never felt that intensely about a celebrity before. And I remember writing diary entries about it. And I was like, this is insane. This is insane. Wow. Oscar Isaac. Oh my gosh. And I also loved reading like Finn Poe fanfic. So after that too, I was like in the trenches. Yeah.
Deep in the trenches. Oh my God. That's so funny. I did not have that intense of an experience. I feel like I'm getting FOMO now. That's so funny. I think Zoe Kravitz, I don't need to explain. Just, yeah.
Okay, this definitely wasn't my first one, but I literally just can't think of anything else right now because I thought of this and it won't leave my brain. But I don't even know what year this was. I watched like one of the Ghostbusters movies in the like movie theaters, and I was just obsessed with the one scene. Like, I think Kate McKinnon is the actress's name. I don't remember what her character's name is, and there's just one scene where she licks a gun, and that was enough. That was enough. That's all I'll say.
That's so funny. I remember, I feel like this is like two, like, so the first like made up celebrity crush I had to tell all my like straight besties was Zayn from One Direction. Anyways, I feel like that's like, I don't know. I bring that up a lot now, but I think my first like celebrity crush was probably like, I was watching. What is it, like Gossip Girl? And I think I had a crush on Blake Lively. But I feel like it's so like, it's just so like, okay. Like she's just a pretty person. I don't know.
Okay, and my second fun question for you guys is from our wonderful, divine, godlike audio engineer, Sonia. Is owning or are cats in general gay? There seems to be a correlation between cat lovers and queer circles versus dogs, is our observation from Sonia. So, what is your guys' take on this?
Yes, literally everyone I've dated either has a cat or like is fiending to get a cat. Like I've never met like, I mean I would say like I'm neutral. I'm a dog and cat person, but I think I've never met like a queer like dog person. I don't know. Wait, speak on that, Eden.
I just like threatened to fight Isabel. Cats don't like me. It's not that I don't like them. They just don't like me. And that's okay because cats are like independent. They don't want to cuddle. They just want to like exist outside of your space. I have a sausage dog called Missy with my girlfriend Hannah, and Missy is literally perfection. I love her to bits, and she loves me to bits. So I am a dog person, but I would still say that it's not that dogs aren't gay, but cats are absolutely gay.
I want a Bernese Mountain Dog. I want like a big dog when I grow up.
I have to say, I think dogs are gay, and I think cats are also gay. I think if you are on any of the circles with like trans masks love dog imagery, you know. There's also the world of like being like, I'm a little puppy boy, or I'm a little puppy girl. Like, I think any animal, like, I think cats and dogs are gay, both controversially, I say with my hamster crawling up on my shoulder. Sorry, she was feeling a little stir crazy, and I was like, wait, I'm still up right now, so I might as well like let her have some hangout time.
No, yeah, I think historically speaking, I've decided with Isabel on this, like cats and queerness is so interlinked. Just the imagery of it in my head, it just makes sense. It's very intuitive. And there are like a lot of stray cats like I find in my neighborhood, and just there's an affinity there. Like we see each other. They don't actually care about me. I just love them. I just stare at them for like half an hour, and then I realize like I'm late for school or something. But yeah. It's the connection is there.
Guys, you can't say this because the first thing I think about is the fact that baby me really wanted a dog and now older me really wants a cat and is fiending to get a cat, as Isabel said. And every questioning thought I have ever had in my life came up with this one question, like more than any other thing you guys said. It's just this one question. So thanks for that.
The compet
No,
dog sequel
okay.
should just be like pet related. Like, what do your pets say about your sexuality?
Well, from what we have arrayed here, dogs, cats, and hamsters are gay. And I have had a hamster, I have wanted a dog, and I really want a cat. So, what does that say about me? I don't know.
The
But
stars are aligned.
I mean, we're 4 for 5 right now. Like, We should make it 5 for 5. Anyway, I'm going to stop there. Thank you all for answering all those questions, for being so open about your guys' experience. I for one, found this to be such an amazing and just really wholesome discussion, even though we had some very intense moments here. I'm just so glad that I was able to witness this and be a part of this. And yeah, I am so, so excited. If every conversation we have this season is this constructive, this beautiful, and this just energizing, I know that this upcoming season is going to be so amazing, and it's going to be so wonderful for so many people. So thank you all. And I think that is going to conclude our Q&A Gaysians episode. If anyone has any last words, feel free to say them now or not. Okay.
Tune in to the upcoming episodes.
Yes. If you guys didn't hear that, Naina said, please listen to upcoming episodes. Thank you all for listening. I hope that you guys found this discussion as wonderful and beautiful as I did. And we will see you in our future season 8 episodes. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.
As this episode comes to a close, we'd like to shout out the rest of our team who you don't hear from as often as us co-hosts. Their contributions are integral to the smooth running of Dear Asian Generation, and we would hate to take all the credit for what is truly a huge team effort.
Annika, May, Yolda, and Anya are our researchers, and Sonia is our audio engineer.
Emma, Claire, and Prisha are our social media writers. Rin and Chloe are our social media illustrators. Angel is our social media manager. Our marketing team members are Aaron, Tan, Antonia, and Diane. Jenny is our podcast marketing manager.
And finally, Lindsay is our senior podcast manager. Thanks, team. We couldn't do it without you.
If you love Dear Asian Generation, it would mean so much to us if you would be willing to follow the pod to ensure you don't miss an episode. While you're there, if you'd be willing to give us a 5-star rating with a review and share with a friend, we'd be so grateful. Your thoughts are incredibly valuable, and we appreciate you very much.